This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. How about yourself?
Not too bad. It's getting warmer. So
yep.
I used to have this theory that when it gets warmer, it's like human mating season. So that's when like everybody starts going out and starting to find each other. I don't know if that's
right.
True, but I always thought that was true. Yeah.
Well, I have no doubt that that was true when humans – we're living, you know, for people in northern Asia and northern Europe, but I don't think it had anything to do with things around the equator. So, go
ahead. Yeah, maybe I have some ancestry up in northern Europe.
I expect you did. All right.
All right. Well, today we are going to be talking about a couple of different topics. Now, I was reading the Evolutionary Psychology Journal. Now, you know, it's something I really enjoy reading. There's a lot of deep articles in there, some of which I understand, some of which are just way over my head. But some of them I pick up here and there, and there was one that really caught my eye. Now, the question I titled the show, how different do we act when we're being watched? And so the question is, do we act differently in private versus when someone's watching? And I think that we can agree that the answer is yes. But what the scientists were trying to figure out was how do people act when it's just a picture of eyes watching? Okay, so that's what we're going to be talking about briefly. And also, we're going to be talking about another article that I read in the European Journal of Personality, which is what's best for a first impression? Is it personality that people can observe before they come and talk to you, or is it just the physical features? They were trying to figure this out. You know, it's a small study, maybe a couple hundred college students, but the first one or the second one, right? Personality or physical features? Because that's going to be a really interesting question when we're like, I don't know, parties, business networking events, whatever, however, conferences, however we meet the opposite sex. So, and then we are going to have a question from one of our listeners. He might be calling in, or we just read the question, either one. And then got a pretty sad Darwin Award.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting Darwin Award that we'll read to everybody. So, Dr. Lyle, are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
All right. So the first one, the research from the Evolutionary Psychology Journal. What this article found about eye images. So when people are watching you, it turns out that people do what's called pro-social behavior. So, as opposed to being anonymous or being by yourself, you don't really act the same. So these researchers, they were trying to figure out, is it just eye images? Like, can you take a picture of eyes or a painting and put it in the room and people will act just the same as they would if there were people, like actual people watching? And it turns out that's true, but they were trying to figure out is what if the eyes are closed? What if the eyes have a direct gaze? So like the eyes kind of like, is it like Mona Lisa, right? Mona Lisa's looking at you all the time. Or if the eyes are looking away. Well, they found that when the eyes are actually watching you, they're the direct gaze, then people have a much bigger inclination to be pro-social compared to the eyes that are averted and closed. And then their control group was an image of flowers. So it's really interesting to me because I thought, well, you know, I can put a picture up in my place of eyes watching me, and maybe I'll just keep it clean a little bit more often, you know.
Very good. Yeah, it's actually quite interesting. It's showing that the it's actually showing the neural circuits of the human. So this is clearly an innate mechanism that we are looking to try to be, to essentially alter the inferences people make about what we would be like to trade with. So this is a method for when we're being observed to make it look like we are more benefit, our cost-benefit ratio that we bring to the table is actually better than it really is. And you better do this because your competitors are all doing it since it's a species-wide characteristic. So the so that's actually what's happening here. That's going to be what we call impression management. So I think it's fascinating that all it takes is a painting in the room with some eyes on that painting, and suddenly you're having the effect. You know, it's not shocking that that's true, but it's really quite interesting that it's true. And I think they even did to go even further and having eyes that can follow you, you know, particular painting style is just terrific that that's how they show that effect. So yeah, quite a nifty little study. And I had heard about something like this years ago, but it sounds like this is an update on that and a little greater refinement. So very cool.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's implications for this in terms of motivational behaviors? So for instance, if I'm trying to follow my diet or exercise or, you know, be productive or whatever I'm trying to accomplish, or if anybody's trying to accomplish that, do you think it's helpful to have like that picture of eyes in the, in the room?
It's actually a really good question. You know, I was kind of rolling my eyes at the idea of keeping your room cleaner, but that did not occur to me. So this is a leave it to you, Nate, who's tortured with self doubt. No, I'm just kidding you. No, the truth is that it's actually very interesting. I actually had not thought about adapting that in that way, and so I mean somebody that wants to get a dissertation done ought to have people do a weight loss program and give them paintings to put in their room, and they don't know why, but they just want certain paintings in there. And we can have, you know, water lilies by Monet can be somebody's to quote, you know, we're looking for that. And then somebody else can have something where there's something with some eyes. And so, and then we find out whether or not there's effect. I mean, I think that's a fascinating study and idea. And so, you know, who knows? We'll see what comes of it.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, very, very interesting. Yeah, I'd be curious. Hopefully, if there's some students listening, some psychology PhD students, they can yeah, go and do this. That would be really, really cool.
Actually,
if you do this,
I have to say that would be a remarkable study to do, and one that has the possibility, because conceptually it's fascinating. It's not just
game changing.
Now,
yeah,
now we're not just pro-social behavior, which is what, but now we're going beyond to more important self-regulation in general, and essentially that are to break bad habits and so forth, we are performing only in front of an internal audience. And so if we essentially enhance that internal audience with some outside eyes, you know, a lot of people that struggle with their weight are eating cookies when nobody's looking, but they're eating salad in front of everybody at the lunch table. So if we because of the impression management issues. So to essentially harness a bit of that, there might be an effect there. I'm not sure if there would be, but there might be, and that would be well worth finding out.
Yeah, when I read this, it reminded me when I was about 14 years old, my parents loved listening to this radio show host who was a psychologist, or she was a marriage and family therapist on a big radio station around here. And she used to take calls from people, and she had a phone call from a married man who was addicted to pornography. And so he was asking her, how the hell am I supposed to stop this? I'm married, I got kids, mm-hmm, and like, I'm ruining my life because that's all I'm doing. And she ended up telling him, she was based on Freud. And so she had a lot of,
sure,
thinking that listening to this show, I realize now, is wasn't correct, but she stumbled on this issue. She told him that he has to tape a picture of his family to his computer, so that every time,
yeah,
he loads up the porn, he's got to look at them while he's doing it. And
yes,
and sure enough, he called back like a few weeks later. He's like, oh my God, that's helped me so much. Now we kind of understand why.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, good for her. That's, you know, like you said, she didn't know why, but she was smelling something there, and good enough. Good job.
Close. Yeah. Well, if there's any students that ever do this, do it. Call us to the show, and we would love to hear from you.
there you go. All right. Let's go on.
All right. So our next article is from the European Journal of Personality. Now, I don't think it's an evolutionary psychology journal. In fact, when I looked at the personality traits, they did have the big five in here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But they also had a whole bunch of others, like ambition, you know, certain little things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what they found, what they did, a small study, it was about 300 college students. They claim that the perceived personality traits plays no role in the romantic interest. And here's what they did. They took about 300 college students that watched the videos of potential romantic partners of the opposite sex, just talking about themselves, kind of like a YouTube video of themselves. And then they rated these people personality traits and then their physical attractiveness.
Yeah.
And they reported the extent to which they were romantically interested. Now, what's interesting, and this actually is really cool, is all the girls, they talked amongst each other after they did this, and they almost all agreed on the personality traits that they could tell from the people they were looking at. So isn't that something? That's exactly what you said. And it turns out that they actually found that the physical attractiveness is the most important thing, and actually personality traits played absolutely no role in the romantic interest when they first were thinking of being introduced.
Somebody gets a medal for doing this study. This is a very, very interesting study. And this is a study that interestingly enough, early, way back in the day, 50 years ago, even though 60 years ago, there was early studies on interpersonal attraction. There's like, you know, I think Ellen Burscheid and I can't remember their names, Walster and Walster. It's way back in the day. They would do these studies, and they would find, like, nothing, okay? They would find, they'd come up with some variable, like height is the biggest correlation coefficient, et cetera. And I was extremely interested in those studies as a young social psych student. And I was frustrated because I felt like they were hiding their heads in the sand. Like it, you know, from my standpoint, it was obvious to me what I would be doing in there. And when I'm looking at everybody's behavior, it looks like everybody is following suit on physical attractiveness dominating the show. That would, you know, more evidence for that would come later with David Buss and the rise of evolutionary psychology in this space. But this study, it's amazing that it's been 30 years since David Buss had this thing by the teeth, and now we finally have a study that looks at this so cleanly and shows this, i.e., complete effect for nothing other than physical attractiveness, and personality characteristics go entirely by the wayside. That is fascinating, and the obviously, you could say, well, they don't know that much more about the people, but if the people are talking, you're actually picking up some information about their emotional expressiveness. You're picking up a lot about their personality. So the fact that the personality was not even an issue in computing the individual's mate value for either males or females is just astonishing to me. I'm surprised that it's that's actually a pretty good size study, a couple hundred people. That's a pretty big statistical N. So that would mean that if there are any personality characteristics making an impact, they're making a hell of a small impact, which explains my dating career. there you go. These people nailed it. So there you go. Well done to find that, Nate, and I think that's obviously we're going to find that these factors become very important when it comes to an overall, you know, more complex analysis of the people and deciding on relationships and so on and so forth. But an animal is an animal as an animal, and this human being was a nonverbal casual mating animal before it was anything else. And so the more sophisticated subtle circuits are in play, but it is fascinating that they are dominated by the most ancient circuits first. So good. Very good. Very interesting.
Wow. Yeah, it was really cool.
Interestingly enough, that occurs to me. You know, I won't get this quote right because I can't remember it. But it was Aristotle who said something of the kind. He said, a beautiful face is more important than any letter of reference. Hmm. And so he also said, why is beauty important? Only a person without eyes could ask such a question. And he said, finally, there are three wishes of every man: to be rich, or to be healthy, to be rich by honest means, and to be beautiful. And so this is this study is now bringing this point home. If we already didn't know it, that physical form, you know, dominates this space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
as brutal and as unpleasant as that reality is, it's a reality that it makes sense to confront it head on and understand it, so that to make it less mysterious and not hide under the carpet.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense, and it seems to be in line with a lot of what you've said before in our previous shows.
Sure. Sure.
All right, so we have a caller
okay.
That's calling in. He has a question for Dr. Okay. Lyle. So caller, is this Dan? Dan, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hi, how are you
Dan, doing? How are you doing today? You're on with Nate and Dr. Lyle.
How you doing
there?
Doing
well. Good, good. Can you guys hear me okay? Because I'm kind of
we can hear you just fine,
sure
Dan.
I cover my question while I'm reading it on speaker.
All right.
I want to say I love listening to your guys' show because I've been a huge fan of evolutionary psychology since I heard Jeffrey Miller on another mm-hmm. podcast. One of the things that I've been hearing and listening is, Dr. Lyle, you talk a lot about the idea of nature versus nurture, and in relation to like the five factor, and I may be getting this wrong, correct me if I'm wrong
sure.
anywhere I'm saying this, but with the five factor model, that it's based off of nature, and that's determining the character, which essentially determines the behavior of an individual. But I guess the thing I'm thinking about is that kind of with my journey of kind of, looking at myself and mm-hmm. seeing things that I want to improve upon in terms of my
right.
my behavior, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I feel like I've seen things in my past that have made me behave in ways that maybe, let's say, from the idea of giving value to myself, so I'm putting other people down in my head, for example. Ultimately, that's ways that I find value so that I can feel better about myself. And I believe I attribute that to something like not, being appreciated by those around me, sometimes by my family and maybe those around me. I don't want to say my friends, but just, school and things like that when I was younger. And I attribute that type of behavior of doing that to or finding value in my intelligence rather than, let's say, finding value in who I am naturally and what I already have. So, and I understand that there's a lot of overlap with, certain things of wanting resources and things like that. Like, for example, that sometimes people that are, let's say, have bad experiences when they're younger. A lot of people say this in normal culture and, pop psychology type stuff. They say that it's when someone is bullied or whatever, has troubles when they're younger, they're really motivated to succeed. And I think that idea essentially goes back into what you talk about with evolutionary psychology of wanting resources, and some people are more aggressive about that and things like that. But, I guess I feel like there is some overlap with nurture, and I guess if you can kind of speak to that, because it's like sometimes when I think about, like, why is somebody shy,
mm-hmm.
And things like that, and I relate it somewhat to some of the things I've experienced and some of the ways that maybe what I've experienced has maybe covered up or affected some of the attributes that are the traits that are of my five-factor model, you know what I mean? So,
right. No, these are really good. These are really good questions, and this is very, very honest sort of introspection that you're doing, and you're trying to connect some dots. So let's just sort of take things back for a moment before we go forward. So the first of all, your life experience is going to be an interaction between your personality, your natural personality, and the environmental events that come your way. So you could be born an extremely naturally happy soul with a lot of confidence and great emotional stability and extroversion, et cetera, and openness to experience. And then you wind up getting thrown into a Russian gulag and tortured for the next 37 years. Now, during that entire time, you will be miserable. So the environment is essentially dominating your life experience. Now, when you are released, nobody in their right mind would say that you will not have been impacted by this. However, I will say that if we look at you 5 years after you're released, you are going to be remarkably similar to your identical twin brother who was never in that gulag. Okay? So will you be somewhat different? Yeah, you'll be somewhat different, but you will not be dramatically different. And if we had you take personality tests and we actually talked to you, if we put you in circumstances that we're going to call functionally equivalent circumstances. So let me just sort of wind out here to try to explain a little bit about genetics and environment and how they work. So what I want you to think about is I want you to think about a gene causes something to happen in the body. So a gene causes the body to build a nose, or the gene causes a body to build hair or teeth, et cetera, et cetera. And a gene is going to cause, for example, your skin to look like the way that it does. Now, then the environment is going to be acting on that, and the result is going to be essentially a combination between how the environmental factors impact those specific genes. So if you go out in the sun, you're going to start darkening the skin a little bit, dependent upon how much sun that you get and how your genes are built in terms of melanin in the skin and so forth. That the degree of that change is going to be what we call the reaction range. So if you feed kids different diets, it will affect their height. So if you starve a kid and make them extremely deficient in their diet, they're not going to become as tall as they otherwise would have become. But we're also going to understand that through a normal course of events that are consistent with sort of natural inputs for the species, that person is going to be essentially about as tall as they were going to be. So Shaquille O'Neal, more or less, was going to be Shaquille O'Neal. He's wound up being 7'2". Now, had he had slightly different diet characteristics, it might have been 7'1¾", or it might have been 7'2¼". There might be that much reaction range around height, maybe more. There might be an inch on either side of this, but not too much. We would have had to give him an extremely deficient diet and have him be really in trouble for him to be only, say, 6'11", to have made that big of an impact. So this is the notion of reaction range. So if you take a kid who is in a normal environment, is going to wind up with 140 IQ. He's going to be a 99th plus percentile brain. That kid, it's going to be very difficult for us to put him in an environment where something very close to that isn't going to happen. So we may put him in an environment where he winds up with, you know, winds up being 98th percentile. Pretty hard to put him in an environment where he would wind up at 95. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the human being is pretty much the human being physically and in terms of its mental characteristics, and you can't shift it around too much with environmental inputs. Now, you would expect that if you had extraordinary environmental inputs, like we put you in a cage and treat you like a monkey for 5 years, then we could expect that there would be some output, you know, some changes that would take place that would be potentially significant and problematic. But that is not most people's life experience. So let's talk about life experiences that I'm going to say are going to come under the heading of normal. So normal is going to be, I got embarrassed in front of the whole school when I was in this eighth grade because, you know, I was supposed to do the talent show and then I got up there and just choked and I couldn't, you know, I was supposed to sing and I couldn't do it, okay? Or I got, you know, I really wanted to be on the basketball team, but I got picked last, and et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, I peed my pants in the third grade and the whole school found out about it, et cetera. These are all normal outcomes of situations that will happen to a social animal that's living in close proximity and its behavior is being monitored, et cetera. Bullied is another one. Okay, so these are all normal courses of events. So we would not expect we would not expect substantial reactions away from what the genes are going to be building with respect to these individuals. And we don't find them. Okay? So the psychologists, of course, don't know this. They don't understand how tightly constrained. They would think, for example, the way there are people that if you said, well, if you feed your kids really well, they'll get to be tall. You know, your son would be 6 foot, but if you feed them junk food and McDonald's and everything else and that kind of crap, they're only going to be like 5'8". So they might think that the reaction range was 4 inches, which turns out to be what we call a standard, you know, 2 standard deviations, for God's sakes. So it would take somebody from, you know, or, you know, I think that is, I think the standard deviation for height in males is a couple of inches or so. So in other words, it would possibly take somebody from the 16th percentile to the 84th percentile, depending upon diet. Well, that's not true. Okay. So the diet doesn't have anything close to that kind of an impact. It has a very tiny impact. It might take somebody from 75th percentile to 78th percentile. It might be 3/8 of an inch. So in the same way, these personality characteristics have been shown to be quite robust with respect to what we're going to call functionally equivalent environments. It doesn't really matter with your height if you're eating Italian food or Chinese food or junk food or whole foods, plant-based, pristine food from the time you're a little baby. It doesn't make any difference. By the time you're 20, your height is going to be essentially your height. It's provided that there was sufficient calories for the basic machinery to operate. So the concept of functionally equivalent environments is very, very important. And we're going to find out about how much variance these different variant environments, the vast majority of environments, are going to be within ranges where essentially the environments are having impacts on the genetic code. The genetic code is not going to be modifying that person's personality hardly at all. That's why we find in these long-term studies with monozygotic twins that are being raised by different people, we find that their correlation coefficients are so high. And they are about the same degree as high as whether or not those people are raised by the same people or they're raised by entirely different people. So I believe someone could check me on this. But I believe that, for example, with respect to intelligence, the correlation coefficients of people that are raised in the same household by the same people, the correlation coefficients on intelligence is 0.85, and the correlation coefficients if they're raised in different households by different people are 0.8. Okay, almost no difference. Now, so what does this mean for us? It means that when it comes to your essentially basic personality structure, you are who you are. And when it comes to things like shyness, how motivated you are to succeed, all this kind of stuff, this is all going to be kind of in the cards. The question is, does environment impact anything about you? Well, it impacts a great deal about you, but it doesn't impact your personality. So if you're in the Russian gulag, you're suffering. If you've got a mother who's a snarling, pushy bitch that's unbelievably difficult to get along with, then your childhood is full of moods of unhappiness and anxiety and stress. Now, my friends in both learning theory and in psychodynamic theory will think that this is going to have something to do with your personality when you're 30. I will argue that it doesn't, and the research evidence supports me and not them. Okay. So what your mother is like, how it is that she treats you, doesn't appear to have any discernible impact on people's personalities. Now, you might say, well, does it impact them at all? Well, undoubtedly it does to some degree. So, for example, when it comes to Mother's Day, I think you're going to have a different reaction than somebody who had a great mom and had a great time with her mom, with your mom. I think when it comes to Christmas time and Thanksgiving, this is going to impact you. So you're going to not be so anxious to call home and think about we're all getting together for the holidays. It may result in you valuing a mate that is a little more stable and warm and loving, and you may be a little less risk tolerant with respect to some personality characteristics and potential mates if any of them sort of remind you of your mother. In essence, you may become a little more sensitive to disagreeable characteristics than you otherwise might have been. So in subtle ways that your environment is impacting you, in the sense that and there's other things that you mentioned that are interesting. So for example, you talked about your own internal rehearsal processes when you see people and then they're potential competitors, and then you think through where it is that you are at an advantage with respect to them, et cetera, and you feel critical of them. This is a natural human characteristic. Now, there are people that may not do this very much. Now, I've never met one. I've met people that do it so constantly they're annoying to talk to. And so what this really is that this is an issue about natural competitiveness and actually disagreeability. So people that are very, very agreeable will have that kind of process happening less. People that are normal will have it happen fairly often with respect to anybody who is seen as a competitor within their ecological niche. And people who are naturally disagreeable will have it happening all the time, particularly with respect to almost anybody that is shining in any field at all. A highly competitive, disagreeable individual will find ways to clip down the tall poppies and assert themselves as above them. So this is not anything, so you may have been highly conscientious and very decent human being and therefore thinking that slightly ashamed of yourself, Dan, that this is part of your internal process, but I assure you that this has been part of my internal process for decades. Okay, and so this is
you just made me feel
very,
a lot better, by the way.
What's that?
You just made me feel a lot better about myself, by the way.
Very good, very good. So this is a useful thing to know, I suppose, that if you're hyper conscientious and a really decent person, that you might be feeling bad about having this essentially highly critical chip, particularly. And I think I would argue that we would likely see it in circumstances where anybody was potentially invading on some status that you wanted, okay? And so that's an innate mechanism inside of humans. Essentially inside your own head, what you're doing is potentially rehearsing the criticisms that you would actually utilize in communicating with other people, particularly, for example, attractive females, about how it is that this guy's achievement, where he's getting some shine, really isn't that worthy of admiration. And in fact, she should discount all things about him that are apparently noteworthy and praiseworthy. Okay, does that make some sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely some other aspects of that whole idea that I would love to talk more about, but I think that's not necessary at this point.
Sure, sure, very good. I can't remember some other things that you said. Did we? I'm trying to think if I explained this. So let me back up and just to bore everybody for a couple more minutes. Yeah, sometimes when people hear me, I don't get my point across, or I don't get it completely said, The environment is very important. In fact, your environment is an unbelievably important feature of how enjoyable your life is going to be. So what mate you choose is an enormously important issue. Who your friends are, what work you do, where it is that you live, okay, et cetera. The family that you're born into and that you are interconnected with, these things can be critically important features of how enjoyable or miserable your existence is. They do not, however, influence what we're going to call your personality. So when parents, I have parents that will be quite concerned about the shaping of the personality of their offspring, about whether or not their offspring are going to become good people, about whether offspring are going to be smart, whether they're going to be ambitious or lazy, all these kinds of things. And it turns out that they are truly wasting their time. Because those issues, how ambitious, how lazy, whether or not they're going to be upstanding, decent human beings and be honest and et cetera, honest, straight, rule-following, achieving and conscientious adults, whether or not they are going to be really nice people and be pleasant to other people and be empathic and nice to animals, these things are determined at conception and will not be influenced by the process of development, provided, once again, the caveat that we do not have extraordinary environments, okay? And virtually no one in the United States lives in an extraordinary environment. And so for all intents and purposes, who it is that you are is yours. It's yours alone. And our job is to take whoever that person is and try to strategically move yourself into the very best set of circumstances to enjoy your existence to the maximum degree. Okay? Sound reasonable?
So if I could sum it up really quickly, would it basically be accurate to say your genetics determines how you react to certain environmental experiences?
Yes. Very good. Excellent. That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
You got it. All right, sir. Very good. Thank you very much for calling. Great questions.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Yeah, Dan, thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it. Great question. As you were telling Dan that you also have these critical thoughts of everybody, I was thinking, I was just at the gym today and I try to go, three, four times a year and I go to the gym and I was, and there was this like guy doing bench press, so he's got like two of those like huge 45 plates on each side. And he's like doing these bench press. And of course there's a couple of cute girls watching him. And I just think to myself, man, this guy's doing it all wrong. So after he's got the wrong form, he's arching his back, whatever I'm coming up with. So of course, as these cute girls stay there and he finishes, I decide like, I'm going to show him how it's done. So like after I like struggle to remove all three plates on each side of the bench press, I put my little five pound weights on there and I just show
two
him
and
how
a
it's
half.
Done. So
two and a half.
I was trying to show off, so I was trying to bluff a little bit more, but so I showed them how it was done. They didn't really see, but I think it's just because there was a lot of people at the gym.
Good story, man. Very good. That's a very good question. I'm glad that listener asked that question because it's useful for me to try to get that clear.
Yeah, that was
all right. What else we have?
Thank you very much. Well, we've got So tell us a little bit about what's been going on in your life. Have you been to any conferences? Any interesting stories?
I did. I went to an Engine 2 conference. That's a food thing down in. I was down in Los Angeles. Noticed that I didn't look you up. So at any rate, we'll skip over that little detail and just go away. So anyway, I went to the conference.
I knew you were there.
There's a lady there that had known me. I had met her before, And she came up to me and asked me in her very intelligent concern about our new president and what this was going to mean for our future, et cetera, and was clearly worried and respected my opinion for whatever reason, because I know a lot about carbohydrates and protein and fat, so that would make me an expert on world political, you know, outcomes. Anyway, so I started to explain something to her, and after I gave her about a 5 minute or 10 minute download, that I'll truncate that here. She was really excited to hear this because she had never had this concept. It never occurred to her. And so I think I've talked about this before here, but I want to reiterate this for people in our audience in case this is a part of my thinking that they've never heard. And that is that the world is getting massively better very, very quickly and will continue on into the future indefinitely. Humans essentially have solved the problem of how to deal with nature. And people don't really know this. And so they're still worried about the environment, and they're worried about pollution, and they're worried about, you know, conflict between peoples, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be problems. We're looking at the tail ends of the mess here, folks. People are quite unconscious of how different life is than it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And for that matter, from 200 years ago all the way back to the dawn of written language and before. In the last 150 years, or about 200 years now, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution in England, what we have seen in places where we have a free enterprise, free market system that has the natural incentives that come with trade and limited constitutional governments, what you've seen is a 3% increase annually in humans' ability to essentially manipulate molecules and put them together in combinations that improve human life. That's what we're doing here, is we are moving atoms and molecules around in ways to serve human interests. And 200 years ago, they would have had no idea what was going to come. The life that you live now is unimaginable from people living in 1825. And it's equally unimaginable for people who are living in 1917. So at 3% a year, there's a little mathematical law called the law of 72, which is a little heuristic for figuring out how long it takes to double your money under a given interest rate. So at 3% rate of return times 24 years equals 72. So it figure that it takes basically 25 years to double the human ability to turn resources into things that you want, which means the price of everything gets cut in half, which means that people have to use half as much labor to get what they got before. So by 1850, the standard of living in England had doubled from where it was in 1825. By 1875, it had doubled again, and by 1900, it had doubled again. And by 1925, it had doubled again, and by 1950, it had doubled again. And by 1975, it had doubled again, and by the year 2000, it had doubled again. And between the year 2000 and 2025, it will double again. Now,
what about from 2025
you're in the middle of it.
To 2050?
Yeah, and it's going to double again. So
okay.
What's going to happen is, in the next 100 years, from the year 2000 to the year 2100, there will be approximately a 16-to-1 impact on income in places where that are touched by free markets. So your children or your great-grandchildren will be 16 times wealthier than you are today. And that being the case, there isn't going to be any problem having the water clean or the forests or anything else. The population density of the world will peak at about 9 billion in about 2050, and then it will not rise thereafter. So we essentially have all the people on the planet that we're going to have. I was at the conference, and somebody was lamenting how terrible it was all going to be and that we all had to become vegetarians in order to sustain the planet. This is all totally ludicrous. I don't point that out to my friends in the vegan movement. It's just no point in trying to re-educate them. The point is that this job is done. Human beings have figured out how to do this, and we have solved the problems in principle. So, of course, when you look out the world, you see a lot of poverty. You also see you still have nation states where there's disagreements and very serious potential problems. You've got some narcissists in the capitals of the world, like in North Korea and in Iran, that are trouble, and their nuclear bombs could drop, and it would be astonishing if human beings got through a nuclear age for 150 years and didn't have a nuke drop somewhere. I'd be really surprised if we managed to pull that off. We probably will. We'll probably have something happen, and it's going to be a great tragedy. And, 3 million people are going to die, and the whole world is going to gasp, and everybody's going to realize, wait a second, we can't have this. I don't believe you'll ever see this with the superpowers. They're too smart, too sophisticated at this point. Nobody's interested in that. That's not where any of the troubles are. So what we look at is the following, that the problems today are interesting problems, and they're important problems. And so it's perfectly legitimate for people to be working on those problems and make them a little better. But in the long run, there's no way all these problems don't get solved. So you can imagine the consternation of people, in New York City, like, what are we going to do about all the horse manure that's on the street in 1900? And you can imagine all kinds of, hand-wringing and tearing of hair and trying to figure out what we're going to do, because we are knee-deep in horse crap, okay, as the population rises. They would have no idea how easy and how smooth and how brilliantly human beings would solve this problem in 100 years. In the same way, the problems that humanity faces will be solved and solved very easily and brilliantly in the next 100 years. So your job isn't to be sweating about some dark, dismal future with problems. Your job is to figure out how you're going to optimize your personal happiness in the now and let the world and its future take care of itself, because it's taking care of itself brilliantly. You could not stop the innovation that is taking place right now. The information is located in hundreds of millions of heads backed up on hard drives all over the world. All that's going to happen now is that human beings are going to continue to innovate. Things are going to continue to get better, cheaper, faster, cleaner. That will not stop. Okay? If anybody wants to read a book that's the definitive argument on this topic, it's called The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley, who is a tremendous mind. And if you need a good, solid dose of data to cheer you up about your future, that's it.
Excellent. A couple of weeks ago, I just was reading an article on this new bacteria that that scientists discovered could actually eat plastic. And so I remember when I was like getting into the health movement, I was reading articles and constantly thinking like, oh my God, people are, the planet's not going to survive because of all the trash and plastic. Here we go.
Right.
Now I realize they'll figure it out.
Of course.
I don't need to get into that.
Absolutely. One thing they will not figure out that everybody thinks that medicine's going to figure out, they think that medicine's going to figure out all these little problems with respect to health. They won't. We're hitting up against the genetic constraints of humans. Humans are going to live about 85 years plus or minus 10. That's what it is, and we're essentially getting to the constraints now. So don't smoke cigarettes. Eat a decent diet. Get some decent exercise. And enjoy your life, because they're not going to give you any more of it.
Fantastic.
All
excellent.
Right.
This is great. And I think you have a few minute audio of this. If anybody wants to hear it again, you can listen to podcast, or you have a little audio of this on your website, esteemdynamics.org, right? And it's like world is going to hell or something like that.
Right.
So
that's right. I did that. I forgot about that. Thank you. Got it.
All right. So, let's do our Darwin Awards.
Okay, let's do our Darwin Award and call it a day. All right, let's hear it.
All right, our runner-up here, this was a man who, he was under arrest, and the defendant, his name is Daniel. I don't want to give his last name because it's just too embarrassing. But he fled from the police, and after he was pulled over for erratic driving, and he had been drinking alcohol. And what he did was he took his underwear, he ripped his underwear off while the officer was pulling him over, and he ate his underwear. And his thinking was that hopefully the cloth would absorb the alcohol before he took a breathalyzer test.
Yeah.
So he ripped off his underwear. They handcuffed him, and while he was in the back of the patrol car, he ate the fabric. Unfortunately, he still registered 0.08%, the blood alcohol limit. But that wasn't enough to convict him of driving under the influence. So I guess it worked a little bit.
All right.
So let's do our winner. Shorten that drum roll.
Yes.
All right. So this was a lawyer in Toronto. His name's Gary.
Yeah.
He loved to tell his buddies that the windows in his corner office were bulletproof and unbreakable. So one day he decided to prove his theory by running into one at full pace in front of his clients. Yeah. Of course, the shocked clients watched as he crashed through the unbreakable windows and flew right out the 24-floor window.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Wow.
Don't even want to put the laugh track on because it's a little sad.
No, that's amazing. That's you're looking at some very interesting characteristics there, personality-wise, and you're looking at some sort of disagreeable dominance, open to experience. It's some interesting and unusual combination there led to that. Fascinating, bizarre, macabre. You know, that's about as bad as it gets. Wow, what a story. All right, that's just a little tip. That's a little tip to our listeners not to do things like that.
Yeah, I'd be willing to bet there was a good-looking woman in one of his clients that were up there
watching
us.
Yeah, and he just had to grandstand just a little too much. Wow. Did not beat the jeans.
He did not.
No.
All right. Well, there we go. Thanks, Dr. Lyle. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.